My name is Todd Wagner. I'm a health economist out here at the Herc. I've been in VA for, 18 years now. So that's a picture of me, so you have a sense on my graying hair. What I'll be talking about today is estimating the cost of an intervention. What I typically say to people is there are sometimes when you're looking at healthcare interventions, and you can look at administrative data, and you can see, because these interventions are really widely used, you can see the cost of them. But you guys are creative, and there are many times when you're coming up with new interventions for which we don't have a cost observable in any of the administrative data that we have. So here are some examples that we'll sort of highlight throughout the talk today. So imagine you're putting together outreach workers to improve cancer screening, and so you're curious about, you know, I want to hire these outreach workers, I want to train them, and then get them to work with patients who have need cancer screening needs. Another one that we worked on in the past was what happens if you designed a new cool robot that would improve stroke rehabilitation? Well, this is a brand new device, never been used before, and so the question then becomes, what's the cost of this device, especially for providing stroke rehab? And then there might be, what's the cost to run a telephone case monitoring program for people with substance use recovery? So hopefully you'll have a sense on you're thinking about these new innovations in healthcare, and it's not easy to think about observing the cost of these interventions in the administrative data that we have. So just to orient you, as we go through today's talk, I have roughly 50 slides today, but some of those are examples, and we have some poll slides and so forth. So we'll make those available as we can. There is also on your screen a chat screen. So if there are questions that come up, you're all muted, but please type in a question. If it's a clarification question, I have Jean Yoon, who's a health economist here, and she'll probably interrupt me and ask me to clarify something. And if it's a bigger question, we might hold it to the end, and hopefully we'll have time for questions at the end. So hopefully at the end of the seminar today, you'll understand what microcosting means as a method. And you'll understand that there are different microcosting methods and that the way that you use these methods will affect your future analyses. And I'll show some of these. One of the key aspects of whatever we do, economic analyses, is thinking about the perspective and really whose costs are we counting here. So you might need to vary your methods or the methods that I present here depending on if you have a different perspective. So typically we have perspectives, and you can see a number listed here, societal perspective, which would include the payer, the patient, the provider's costs, and so forth. You might have a more narrow perspective. You might be just interested in the patient perspective. For example, let's say you're interested in caregiving. You might say, let's really look at just the patient perspective. So just keep in mind that as I present these today, typically I'm coming at this with a societal or payer perspective, and I'll try to highlight that. But you might need to orient and reorient your questions or methods depending on a different perspective. So I have a poll question here for you. What kinds of economic analysis interests you? I'm just trying to get a better sense of who's in the audience today. I see that there are 169 attendees, but I don't see your faces. So now there should be an open poll that Heidi works her magic.
Yes, I have the poll open. I have the poll set up. You can select all that apply. I know sometimes that takes a little bit longer to answer when you don't get to choose just one, but responses are coming in. I'll give everyone a few more moments, then I'm going to close it out and go through the results here. And it looks like we've slowed down, so I'm going to close that out now. And what we are seeing is 40% of the audience saying cost identification, 78% of the audience saying cost effectiveness analysis, and 67% saying implementation, for example, budget impact. Thank you, everyone.
Yeah, thank you. That's great. I must say that I've been involved in analyses that do all three of these, not necessarily at the same time, but some of the questions that we get are really interesting questions, just trying to identify the cost of the care. And for example, that robot was a real challenge trying to figure out what is the cost of a unit of care when you see a robot? So let me go through this. So I have an outline here. there's an introduction that I'll go through. I'll talk about the methods. There's a number of slides on the methods. And then I'm going to have a segue to talk about what we think of as production and efficiency and economies of scale. What I'll try to do in case you have to step away or you get lost, there's a blue bar on the top of your slide, and that really has where we are in the slide deck as we go. So you'll see as we go through the introduction, then you'll see it shift over as we start the method section, you'll see it say methods and so forth. And then at the end, I'll walk you through two examples, hoping to stay real with the data. So outreach workers, and this is one of the examples that I'm going to pick up on later on. I'm just presenting the question to you now so that as we get into the methods, you can think about how this might apply to you. So this was a local hospital who routinely performed pap smears in the emergency room when clinically indicated, and they had terrible follow-up among abnormal pap smears. They were getting about 30% follow-up among women who had an abnormal pap smear. And so the question then became for them is, how do we improve follow-up? This is what we think of as high-risk women. How do we improve follow-up? And so they decided that they wanted to hire outreach workers to connect with these women and try to let them know about the seriousness of this issue and bring them back in. So what's really the added cost of using outreach workers? So I think of this as a labor-intensive intervention. So here's another one that we're going to talk about a little later on. So engineers at MIT had developed these robotic devices to facilitate rehab for your arm after you had a stroke. Now, these robots are not like you think of a robot. It's not like a C-3PO or something like that. These are units that are pretty just metallic looking, but offer very precise repetitive actions to help the patient with impairment. So you can do things like work on a specific direction if you're having problems with direction. If you're really slow after your stroke, you can work on speeding that up. Or maybe you're spastic and you need to improve your control. So the question for us is, what's the cost of this robotic enhanced rehab? This is what I think of as not necessarily a labor-intensive intervention, but a capital-heavy intervention. You're going to have to buy this unit and get this unit up and working and keep it working. So the answer to these, we're going to use micro-costing methods. And I say that because you can't look at any of the VA administrative data, or for that matter, in any of the Medicare data, and say, here's where it's been used, we'll just use that cost estimate. So you have to do a little bit of your own building of the models here. So micro-costing is a term referring to a set of methods that researchers use to estimate costs when the costs aren't known. And we have to do this because, as I said, they're not observable either in administrative data or in sort of competitive market data. There's no such thing as that really in healthcare anyway. So you're going to have to figure out how you're going to put together this cost estimate. In my experience, there are more than three, but there are three commonly used methods. The first method we call direct measurement, where you're going to directly measure the activities that happen. So think back to that outreach worker. You're going to track the outreach workers, what the activities they're doing, and then you're going to assign prices to them. A pseudo bill is you're going to be capturing services using billing codes. So you might say, hey, this is very similar to this billing code, and we just need to do a better job enumerating these billing codes and assign costs to those billing codes. And then cost regression might be, hey, we don't in the VA have anything like this, but we see maybe there was a private demonstration project in Florida that did a very similar thing, and we could use statistical techniques to use the Florida data to elaborate on what it might cost in VA. I won't spend a lot of time talking about the pseudobill and cost regression. We have some on our website. I'll spend most of the time talking about the direct measurement because that's what we typically get asked questions about. So there are also a lot of questions about when you're selecting a method, you have to think about the data availability and the feasibility, as well as how deep in a hole you want to get into some of these. And so there's never easy answers for these, but HERC has a help desk, and we often answer questions about how much time and effort people want to spend on these methods. There's assumptions built into the methods, and then there's precision and accuracy, and I'll talk about these issues as we go. So direct measurement. There are four things that you need to do. First is you have to specify the production process. So if you're thinking of that outreach workers, you've got to hire people, you've got to have space for them to work, they've got to be able to do their activities. So that's the sort of enumerate the inputs for each of these processes, identifying the price for the inputs, And then you're going to sum together. You're going to say, here's the total cost of all of these outreach workers. And then you have to attribute those costs to the patients. So the level of precision is critical in this effort, and I have specific examples later on about that. But sometimes this is a little bit abstract for people if you haven't done it before. But everybody's cooked a meal, and I find that this example works really well. So what is the process of producing a meal? Everybody knows you got to get ingredients. You got to use your equipment. Sometimes that's, you know, your own equipment. Sometimes you borrow it. You have to cook the meal, and then hopefully you're cleaning up. Really, the nice thing about this production process is you think of it as a natural sequence of events. You have to make sure that you've got each of the events in the process. That's just the same as in healthcare. So you also have a cost of cooking. You can translate that production process into cost, and you buy the ingredients. You might have to rent or buy space. You have utilities that are employed when you're cooking, and then you have the cost of your cleanup. So again, that is very much implicit. There are two things that I want people to think about when they think of this production process and enumerate it. One is efficiency and one is quality. These both relate just to cooking as well as to healthcare. So it's really important that you think of these things as you're doing your healthcare thing. So efficiency is the idea that you use fewer resources to produce the same or more outputs. And you could be more or less efficient. So somebody who has a lot of experience cooking is typically faster at cooking. They can produce more, entrees, if you will. The other thing to keep in mind is that quality, is that the services that increase the likelihood of the desired health outcomes are constant and with current professional knowledge. But in the question of cooking, huge variance in quality. You can take the same inputs, arrange them and have a terrible meal, or you could take the same ingredients, arrange them and have an amazing meal. So those things are often not observed easily in healthcare, and they're going to pose problems for us forever. There's no easy solution, but you have to keep them in mind. So here we sort of translate these back into cooking, and then we can translate them into healthcare. So think of efficiency and quality in cooking. And you're buying your ingredients. Maybe you're buying farm fresh ingredients that you think just taste better. Maybe you have great equipment. Maybe you have skilled labor. Skilled labor is going to be really important when you think about healthcare too. Maybe you're using people who've done this a lot. So they have high volume, just like high surgeon volume, and they've got a lot of experience. So you have this learning by doing. Questions of specialization and so forth. So this process really matters. If you're developing a new intervention, you could imagine where you might have a startup period where this is all just like starting up a restaurant, where it's a real challenge to get these things sorted out. These things typically transfer to medicine. What's really unique about healthcare and medicine is risk and uncertainty. And Ken Arrow wrote a great paper about this in 1963, won the Nobel Prize later. But these issues, you can do certain things in production. Let's say you're making a car. Whenever you put these A, B, C together, you get the car. In healthcare, that's not always the case. You can put A, B, C together, and a patient may die. Patient may live. There's just that level of uncertainty that comes with healthcare that doesn't happen typically in firm manufacturing. So returning to healthcare, efficiency and quality are going to be important to healthcare to all we do. They are often unobserved, and yet they're correlated with cost. So there's no easy solution here, but it's important to think about how they might be affecting your analysis as you go forward. So we'll return to some of these issues later on, but they are one of the things that health economists obsess about. So I have a slide here that shows the sort of the costs of producing healthcare. The example that I'm going to give you now is surgery. Imagine you had some pre-op. In the pre-op, you're going to understand the patient preferences and the risk assessment to make sure that the surgery is going to go well. You then do the surgery. The patient then recovers in the surgical intensive care unit. And then they're worked with discharge planners to make sure that they understand what's going to happen, and then they're discharged. So throughout this production process at each stage, you're going to track things like personnel, space, supplies, training, and contracts. These are the typical five that I tell people to focus on when they're estimating the cost of a new healthcare intervention. Make sure you understand the personnel. Make sure you understand the space needs. Make sure that you understand supplies. Sometimes supplies are trivial. Maybe it's just a computer or pens or paper. Maybe it's much more than that, for example, a robot. Training is sometimes needed. Sometimes you have to send your staff out for training. And then there are sometimes contracts that are involved that you wouldn't want to say that we're perfect because you're hiring another firm to do part of your intervention, so you have to include those costs. I will say that one of the challenges when you're producing healthcare is that there are different time horizons, and these very much confuse many people. So when you buy a robot, that robot's going to live for many years. It's sort of a fixed cost when you purchase it, and then it's going to have a lifespan versus something that varies across each unit that you produce. We'll have to work through some of these issues as we estimate the cost of different interventions, but keep in mind that there could be these time horizons that we need to think about. And I will note that economists and accountants define these differently, fixed versus variable. So earlier I mentioned that this issue of precision is important, and I want to give you an example of what we mean by precision. So imagine your intervention used two full-time equivalent employees, so FTE for short, to provide an intervention for 1,000 participants. Now, let's just say you're in a part of the country where labor is not that expensive, so not Boston or San Francisco, so your total labor cost for this intervention is $100,000 per year. A less precise method is to say, wow, we've got 1,000 participants, $100,000. It's really just $100 per participant. That's not very precise, but it's accurate in sort of what it costs per participant. A more precise method might be to say, hey, what we really need to do is track the time spent per participant. So our total cost didn't change, our number of participants didn't change, but we're going to say, hey, some of these participants got a lot more effort than others. And so you might say, we need to apportion more cost to some of these participants. So this is often a question that comes up during some of our studies. And here the issue is, to delve down and be more precise, it's often very expensive. So here's an actual form that we used when we did that pap smear coach intervention. And we worked with the coaches to develop this client contact form. And every time they touched or talked to a woman in the intervention arm, they filled out one of these forms. So that's why it gets expensive, is not only do you have to fill out these forms, you've got to be on top of the coaches to make sure they're completing them and they're completing them accurately. You know, there's a tendency to want to hold to the end of the day or the end of the week or the end of the month, and then by that point you've forgotten really what you've done here and it's not useful information. So you've got to stay on top of them. So we worked with the outreach workers to develop this form, and then managers reviewed them for accuracy each week. And then coach them on things that they could do better, saying, I see you're putting 15 minutes down a lot. Is that accurate, or was it, you know, how often are you doing this? Now, just to note, sometimes people confuse precision and accuracy, and I just want to disavow you of that notion. The center of the target represents perfect accuracy. A and B are equally accurate or inaccurate, if you will, but A is more precise than B. So doing that client contact form gives you a lot more precision about what's going on. Maybe there are some women for whom you're spending a lot of costs on. If you just said it's an average cost is $1,000 per person, you would never be able to know that. It doesn't mean that either one is particularly more accurate. It just means that it's more precise. So one of the ways that we've worked to improve accuracy, which is different from precision, is we did a different study. This was a spinal cord injury vocational rehabilitation program. And we built the data capture form right into Vista. So if I had gone back a few slides where you saw that we built this paper form and had them complete the paper form, well, paper forms are clunky. They're clunky for a number of reasons. But in this intervention, the outreach worker or the healthcare provider was already looking at Vista, so we built in some additional fields that said, how many minutes have you spent with this person? So as they were sort of doing their normal work, they can easily capture the time. So we think of this as it was harder to build this program, but probably more accurate because it was done just while the care was happening. So I say this improved data accuracy. It was a total pain in the butt to do it, though. So the real question here is, when you're thinking about precision, is there's a payoff for being more precise. And the payoff really is the subgroup analyses. So you're going to – it's a real pain to be incredibly precise, but the payoff is being able to say something about subgroups. Going back to that $1,000 per participant, if that's all you did, you would never be able to say, was there a subgroup that was particularly benefiting from this and had maybe cost a lot less. You wouldn't be able to say they cost less because you didn't measure it at that level. You just said it's $1,000 per participant. I have one of my examples that I'll walk through at the end shows this exactly why this happens and the real payoff that you get. I think everybody that I work with or comes to us with questions immediately agrees that the payoff is worth it and they want to get the precision, even if they have really small samples and they probably will never do a subgroup analysis. So I encourage you to think hard about whether you really want to do a subgroup analysis, whether you're outcome data will support that, and then do you really want to spend the time collecting all the cost data? So when we typically walk some smaller studies through this, in the end they're like, you're right, as much as I love that precision, that's the PhD side of me, and maybe we shouldn't collect all that effort or all that data because it's going to be so time-consuming to do it. So, again, I'll have an example at the end of the lecture about the subgroup analyses. So direct measurement, typically there are personnel activities. You're going to measure, as we talked about the outreach workers, you're going to measure the staff time spent on the intervention. I note that many times when we get involved in research is that research staff are doing many things, and we should think about these products that they're doing, and not all of their time should be attributed to the intervention. So maybe they're developing something, and that's going to be a one-time development cost. Maybe they're developing the app that fits into Vista to capture it. Well, that's a one-time development cost, and we want to exclude that. Maybe they're doing some data collection that's just for our study, that has nothing to do with the care itself. It's just as researchers, we want to make sure it's going on. And we don't want to capture that time either. So we really just want to capture time that's focused on providing the intervention. Now, there's a debate about when you should measure the activities of something that's fully implemented. If you're interested in cost-effectiveness analysis, you'd be interested in measuring things when they're fully implemented and up into steam. If you're interested in something like a query or an implementation study, you might be interested in how long does it take them to get up into sort of a steady state when it's fully implemented, and how expensive it is early on when it's inefficient or they're just getting started. So in cost-effectiveness analysis, you want to measure when they're fully implemented. Implementation studies might be interested in understanding a little bit about what that curve looks like. So personnel costs. For a lot of the interventions that people think of, they're personnel heavy. So you may need to include benefits. So many of the times when we're hiring people to do interventions like the outreach workers, we're paying them a salary. You need to include the benefits if they're receiving benefits. You need to include non-productive time. So it's easy to look at that case report form and say, hey, listen, look, sum up all these minutes. And we did this, and we summed up all the minutes, and we really realized, my goodness, we're paying these people 100% time to do outreach, and yet when you sum up all their time in the forms, it looks like they're a half-time employee. So there's a lot of things that are typically done by employees that are not always sort of direct productive time in terms of doing the intervention. So you need to include the indirect non-productive times. It can be things like meeting times. It could be training or other things that go on, and then you just have to figure out, was that for the intervention, or maybe that was for something we don't want to measure? If you're interested in turning these labor inputs into costs, we have a web page that describes how to do that. You're essentially trying to say, what's the cost per hour for this employee? If it's a veteran-specific intervention, you can figure out how to do it. If you're interested in non-VA, Bureau of Labor Statistics. I don't have their website up here, but if you just Google Bureau of Labor Statistics, they have a great website that walks you through things that can help you figure out, okay, what's the cost of a nurse time? They'll say, here's the median cost of a nurse hour, and they'll give you ranges on that so you can vary that as well. So the two very useful sites, the VA and then the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So I'm going to switch methods here. So that was most of the time spent on the direct measurement. I'm going to briefly talk about the cost regression. I think I have a couple slides on this. It's a different method. You're going to say, we have some data not in the setting we want to use it on, and we're going to use the regression model to estimate the marginal cost of an activity. So the caveat, this only really works when there are existing cost data out there. Maybe your data are in Medicare, could be a state database, another data set that you know of. It's not really a good method for a brand new technology or something you're building where the cost accounting may be underdeveloped. So we did a randomized controlled trial here in VA to examine telephone case monitoring, whether it improves substance use care relative to usual care. And we tracked this great detail through the clinical trial. The intervention arm averaged 9.1 phone calls, but the control arm could also have phone calls, and they averaged about 2 phone calls. So you get to see sort of the mean difference, the number of phone calls that they were making. What's interesting is that the MCA, so the Managerial Cost Accounting Databases in VA, actually tracks substance use telephone care, and this was early when the MCA was doing it in these clinic stops here, and we weren't completely sure that it was getting, you know, accurately tracked. So we said, hey, so we know the, you know, sort of total costs in these clinics and for these patients, can we create a regression model that would tell us the cost per phone call? So it gives you just a snippet of our regression model. I note that other covariates are omitted here for brevity, but you can see the cost per phone call. So our regression model, right out of the regression, this is just a linear regression model, shows us that each phone call that they made, according to, if you believe the total cost in the MCA, about $10.50 per phone call. So that's one way to use a regression model. We've also used them from Medicare data to impute it over into VA, and you can do that as well. So the assumptions typically are that the cost and workload are accurately captured or could be modeled accurately with the regression. But keep in mind that assumptions of accuracy could be varied by location. You might need to control for it. And then if the workload's not being captured and you use one of these regression models, you're going to have a bias towards zero. So you could actually run your regression model and say, wow, there's no cost per additional telephone care. And that's probably not the truth. It's just a matter of that your data weren't sufficiently accurate or precise to capture it. Now, there's a segue here, and I don't want to get lost in it, but I do want to note, when you're working with cost regressions and cost models, there is a really large literature. We have some of this on our website. Cost data are notoriously hard to analyze just because of the skewness in the data. And typically, when you look at it, you'll say, wow, 85% of the people are down at the low end of the spending, but then we've got some incredibly high-cost patients. And so when you immediately say, well, the mean takes into account those outliers, you start wondering what's the best way to analyze these data. Error terms are not normally distributed with identical means and variances. There are transformative models like the log cost model and so forth, and GLM models. So GLM are one of the more commonly used models, but the, you know, GLM log gamma, you know, is prone to overfitting. So here's a bunch of papers on this. If you're in this world and lost, just let us know, and we can help you walk through it. And there's a bunch of empirical and statistical tests for helping people figure out what's the right cost regression. We have also given talks, not in this cyber course, but in the HERC econometrics course where we talk about cost regression, so we can also point you to those classes too. All right, so there's an important assumption in all these things, and I want to be, this leads to a poll question, but it goes back to that intervention we created for the pap smears for the outreach workers. So we created this was an intervention for about 1,000 participants. we created a health guide. So one of the things we wanted the outreach workers to do was give the woman a health guide and say, here's what the value of a pap smear is. Because we were a very small study, we paid $14 per guide for 1,000 guides. When we talked to the company, we said, hey, listen, that seems really expensive. Does that price go down if we order more? And they said, yeah, you know, if you're ordering, you know, a couple hundred thousand, we'd sell them to you for $3 a guide. So here's a question I'm going to pose to you all, is which cost estimate should you use for the cost effectiveness analysis? So this is our next poll question. For cost effectiveness analysis from a societal perspective, so that's going to be a key lead into this question, which estimate should you use? 3, 14, or somewhere in between?
And we'll give everyone a few more moments to respond, and I'll go through the answers here. Please answer. We don't know who answered. We're not going to call anyone else for saying the wrong thing here. So please.
That's right. Help it. I will not see your answer, so just answer, if you will.
Okay. Slow down here. So I'm going to close this out. And what we're seeing is 16% of the audience seeing $14 per guide, 34% of the audience seeing $3 per guide, and 50% saying somewhere in between. Thank you,
Adam. Got it. Yeah, so that's your answers point to some uncertainty in this. And what we're going to find is for a cost effectiveness analysis, and these are sort of the typical societal models, one of the implicit assumptions that we have is that there's this, we're producing at a constant economies of scale. And they would recommend that we would use $3 per guide for a cost effectiveness analysis model because it's sort of societal, we would buy large numbers and it would be $3 per guide. Okay, so that was the lead in, and I apologize for tricking you. If you're doing an implementation study, you would use the size that you were running for your implementation study. So that shows a distinction between an implementation study and perhaps a cost effectiveness analysis. So typically for cost effectiveness, we like to think of big systems running these and what would be the cost for big systems. And the key here is this idea of economies of scale. So I have a slide on that. So economies of scale. It's the unit cost, so your y-axis is dollars per quantity or unit cost of producing a good. And we typically say that if you're producing one or two of these goods, it's expensive, but as you produce more of these goods, you typically get better at it and your cost per quantity goes down or your unit cost goes down. So as that cost curve goes down, you see there's increasing returns to scale, which means that you're sort of having benefits as you increase your size of production, and then at some point you have constant returns to scale. And what the guidebooks for cost effectiveness says is we really want to be thinking about where we are at constant returns to scale. And so in the example that I gave you and you pulled on, that'd be the $3. But implementation studies are really interested in this curve and are often trying to figure out where they are or who's going to implement. Maybe you're interested in small county health departments implementing, or maybe if you're in VA, it's a small station or substation or CBOC, and you'd have to think, what would be the cost of that CBOC implementing this? It's much smaller than a very large station. So there, you'd have to be very specific to that size of that facility. So in this whole example that I just presented, we didn't talk at all about quality or the quality of producing or our outreach workers. Were they doing a good job? Maybe one of the outreach workers was terrible. We didn't talk at all about it. So we often assume that quality is perfect and it's unobserved most of the time. But we should note that that's often an assumption we make. And changing the assumptions about cost and quality really could affect our outcomes. And so for the outreach workers, the study was very concerned about the quality of the outreach workers, so had weekly meetings with a manager trying to make sure that they were doing the right thing. And then we did a separate part where we talked to the women to make sure that how they felt about the outreach workers as well. But that's, you know, this issue of quality comes up time and time again not only for new interventions, but for ongoing ones too. So before we move on, Gene, I see we have a lot of questions. Do you have a sense on other ones that are ones that we need to clarify now versus ones that we should answer later?
Yeah, we can go over a couple of questions now. So one of the questions asks, going back to the poll question about the $3 or the $14, this person made a comment, I would need to know the size of the program before I can say which cost to use for the guide. Do you want to comment on that?
You know, that's true. I think if you're, especially if you're doing an implementation study, and so if you were implementing it across a range of sites and they varied in size, you'd want to say, hey, what's the implementation, what's the size at each of those sites? Alternatively, you might say, hey, let's pool all of our purchasing and buy it, you know, at a huge scale. So it depends a little on how it's going to be implemented as well. But for most cost-effective societal perspective models, we're often encouraged to think about a constant returns to scale. So you can note, and what we've included in our paper was the $3 per guide, but then noted it and said, keep in mind that this is an implicit assumption for places that differ in this size, they might have to vary this cost. So there's always the carefully worded paper that describes it to the researcher. Thanks.
Okay. And another clarifying question asks, for economies of scale, what is the unit of production? Is it the number of participants?
So it's usually the number of, it could be the unit of participants, it could be the number of services that you're provided. So for the outreach intervention, we talked about, contacts with the woman. So it was cost per contact. You could normalize that to cost per participant too. So you could, it doesn't vary that much. Depending on how you're thinking about the quantity. You just have to be consistent in how you're thinking about quantity.
Okay. We'll make sure to go over the other questions in the Q&A portion of the session.
Awesome. Thank you, Gene. And if there are easy ones that you just want to respond by email, you're more than welcome to do that. We're about 37 minutes in, so we're starting an example where we can get into it, and hopefully when I present the example, it'll be a little bit more clear, but I'll try to leave time for at the end as well. So this was the estimated the labor cost by direct measurement, an example that I've been talking throughout about. So again, this is the local county hospital routinely performs pap smears in the emergency room. They were really disturbed that these women had abnormal pap smears. About 30% were coming back for follow-up. And they wanted to use outreach workers to improve follow-up. So we had this is the question about the payoff for precision. We had a lot of discussions about, do we want to track the outreach worker time spent for women at great detail? And they said yes. So they said, we think our intervention is going to be particularly valuable for certain types of abnormal pap smear readings. And so we want to track it at that level. So I said, great, we'll do it. So we were interested in sort of the cost effectiveness of using this usual care postal reminder, which was at that time the usual care, with a very tailored outreach intervention compared to a usual care alone. And like I said, they were interested in this risk of disease, and we have very standard metrics in pap smears for measuring the risk of disease. And it's a big enough, we thought it was a big enough study to warrant it, even subsamples. So just to give you a real brief overview of the study, it was a randomized controlled trial. It's going to look a lot like a query study. This was actually done years ago. So this was before we used the terms like step wedge. So usual care was notified by telephone or mail, depending on the degree of abnormality. And then everybody in usual care was switched over to the intervention arm after 6 months. So the intervention arm received usual care, plus they got this additional outreach tailored intervention. And we were really interested in understanding what's the added cost of this outreach intervention, and we measured it using direct measurements. And I've shown you that capture form. So we, like I said, we summed all the intervention costs and divided the number of participants. That would have been the easy way. We didn't do it. We decided to collect very detailed information for each patient. Proved very time-consuming and hard, but it really allowed us to answer this question. Was the intervention more cost-effective for certain subgroups? Because we wanted to answer that and we had reason to believe that it would, we decided to spend all the extra effort. So here's some of the results. So the outreach workers cough. So a usual care is your right column, you see it's 170 participants. And of course they're not getting any of this until 6 months out. So within the first 6 months, these are the costs. You see that the outreach worker costs about $142. So it's not cheap, but it's much more expensive than usual care, which was a dollar, which is just mailing them a letter or a sort of a phone call for the most extreme. There are times where the outreach worker would go to the woman's home. So we included travel costs. We had the office space because they occupied cubicles in the hospital. And so on and so forth. And the outreach worker quality assurance was that weekly meeting with them. And this right here is unit cost is cost per participant. So, you get a chance to see that the total unit cost from societal perspective was $214 in the intervention arm versus 10 bucks in the usual care arm. So if you do a lot of these people, if your facility would see a lot of these abnormal pap smears, this could get quite expensive quite quickly. But the sort of marginal cost about $195 more than usual care. But boy, it was effective. This is your classic. At 6 months, keep in mind I have a vertical line there. You can see that's when we started intervening on the control arm, and that's why the control arm starts to come back together. But throughout the entire first 6 months, there's a huge gap that's very statistically significant. So we see in the usual control care, we see about 30% of the women with abnormals are coming back, just like we saw in the pre-period. But right with the intervention arm, we're getting almost twice that. So we're getting about 66%, 65% coming back. By the end of 12 months, it's hard to compare the red and the blue because the blue at 12 months had 6 months where they had usual care and 6 months of intervention, whereas the red had 12 months of intervention. But you get to see that they're doing pretty well. There isn't a huge change from 6 to 12 months. This is a very standard way of presenting cost per follow-up data. So what you're going to have is the overall. You're going to have a column where it's going to show the cost. You're going to have a row that's control versus intervention. And it shows, the next column shows your incremental cost here. I'm going to get a little pen here so I can pen. There we go. So you get this. Excuse my mousing is not very good. So you get to see the difference, which is just 355 minus 78. So it's the 278. And you have a probability of follow-up. This is the incremental cost per follow-up. It's about $1,000. Now here's this key issue is by severity. So, oh man, my mousing's terrible. So HGSIL. So these are the most severe abnormalities, sort of precancerous lesions. And so the question was, maybe we're doing a really good job with that. And boy, and lo and behold, you notice that if we're really effective, the outreach workers were really effective in this specific group. The cost per follow-up is actually quite good in this group. So you can imagine then if you wanted to, we didn't do it, you could imagine tailoring the intervention specifically for the high-grade lesions if you wanted to, or figuring out ways of further tailoring this and making your program more efficient. So the only reason we got this this table was because we had spent all of that time measuring the outreach worker efforts with each woman. So that was a real trade-off there. And this led us to think about how we should do behavioral interventions and cost-effectiveness analysis. So Mary Goldstein and I ended up writing a paper years ago thinking about how this could affect behavioral interventions. So that I put that site down there. So I have seven more slides and 15 minutes. Gene, your take on it, should I leave the costs of using robots for people, or should we address questions? I haven't seen the questions that you're picking up here.
Yeah, I've been answering questions as I go, so I think you have a few minutes to go over the robot example.
Okay, and then I'll let you keep answering that, and then I can I'll try to get through this relatively quickly. So here's this fancy robot. So everybody was thinking C-3PO. It's not C-3PO. This was the MIT design robot. It's designed to measure a person's problems after having a stroke where they have upper extremity dysfunction and working specifically on to improve that functioning. So the robot can really guide the movement and provides feedback on how the person is doing. So if the person's very slow, it can work on speeding it up. If it's working on direction, you can do the same thing there. So you can see where this comes into play. This robot's expensive. So the purchase price of the robot, and this was back when a number of years ago, and it was still being produced by a company, but it had been spun out by MIT. The purchase price was about $231,000. So this is unlike the labor where you're going to have these employees hired from here on out. What you're really doing is buying this robot for a period of time, at which point you think that the robot's going to turn into junk or something like that. So you have to think about, okay, so what's the lifespan of this robot? I need to purchase it. Well, it's expensive, so I need to include financing it. The robot's unusual in its power needs, and it needs a separate circuit. It needs a separate room, so we had to include those. There are maintenance, so you have to debate whether you're going to maintain the robot yourself and self-insure, or you're going to buy a maintenance contract from the company, and that gets really complicated. Some of these things we didn't have full ability to figure out, would VA be able to self-insure and do it itself? And so we just, in this study, included the maintenance contract. And then we said it's going to depreciate over 5 years, so that at the end of 5 years, the robot essentially has no value left. These things are changing so rapidly and new ones are being adopted that at 5 years, what really would need to happen is they'd have to buy a new robot. So you get to come up with sort of the net present cost of a robot over 5 years is $422,000. So it's much more expensive when you include all that as a capital investment. And then you have to say, okay, so how many patients can we put through it? And what's the benefit to the patients? What's really unique about big capital investments like this is it almost forces you to think like an implementation science researcher. Immediately you would say, we can't easily scale the robot. You can't buy half a robot because you're a smaller facility. You can't buy a quarter robot because you're a smaller facility. So it really only makes sense if you're a facility where you have enough patients to make it work. So there is sort of this threshold in size of patient need to make this even possible. So then we went through the exercise of working out with all of the rehab counselors, sort of the number of possible sessions, how long these sessions would last. One of the really cool things about the robot is if you had a big enough site, you could actually have two robots running and you would only need one physical therapist to run it. The physical therapist can also be running other people in sort of manualized physical therapy while the robot's running, because what you really only need to do is get the person started with the robot and then the robot sort of keeps itself going. So it's got some really unique capabilities. So we figured out the number of slots, rehab slots. As much as you'd like to say it could run 24/7, most patients don't want to come in during the middle of the night for a robot session, so you have to sort of figure that out. And then we figured out, even though it's really expensive, so if I go back a slide, that's $422,000 over 5 years, when you say the robot cost per session isn't so bad. It's $19.65 because you can run a lot of sessions. So it really depends on whether you keep this robot fully occupied. And here's another big assumption, that the people that you occupy the robot are going to benefit from the robot. So what we typically see in big capital investments, let's just say you buy a big robotic surgery or a CAT scan, if you start using it because it's there for all sorts of people for where the evidence of using it is very marginal at best. So this really only works if you're going to show that it's, one, it's effective, and two, you're only using it for people who could benefit from it, and it could be fully utilized. So those are some huge assumptions on a capital investment. And then you get to, because there's, you know, sort of running these robots over periods of time, it's just not one session. The total cost for a robot session is about $140. So this was a three-armed randomized trial that we did, and you get to see the cost data here. So it's the robot, the ICT stands for intensive conventional therapy. There was a lot of concern because the robot is different in a number of ways from usual care, that we wanted to have a usual care that was more controlled, and so that was the ICT. And what we end up showing, we can quickly run through these numbers, but what we end up showing is that the both ICT and robot were better than usual care, but they weren't very different from each other. So that was the sort of results for the robot in the end, and we published that, and I'm happy to talk more about it. But again, some of the key assumptions that you're going to do with any large capital investment is, one, that it's going to be fully occupied, or you have to measure sort of its occupancy use, and probably the more stringent and difficult assumption that it's only going to be used on people for whom are going to benefit from it. So in these robot scenarios, you'd say, well, it was designed for stroke, for upper extremity, and then maybe you have somebody who has a different type of illness with their arm, maybe a blast injury, and you're like, hey, let's throw them on the robot. But there's no data to say that a blast injury is going to behave like a stroke. And so you start expanding your cohort, and there's really little evidence that should suggest that it's cost-effective in those cases. So hopefully that makes sense. So there are some resources to point you folks to. So if you're interested, here's information on microcosting. It's the first link. If you're interested in converting travel distance to money, this is some second links. I will note that the new statistical software apps that people are building are wonderful. So it's a little challenging in the VA environment because we lock down these apps and we don't make them, you can't really push data to them. But Stata, for example, just this year has come out with new resources that tie into the Open Maps project that allow you not only to measure travel time, but typical, travel distance, but typical travel time. These are just great resources. So doing a little bit of sleuthing on these things is great too. And then, like I said, if you're interested in caregiver costs, Louise Russell's paper is fantastic. And then there's the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. I mentioned them earlier. They have a website that can help you walk through. And I went through just the other day and made sure that these links are still good. But there's always the chance that they will die. And then when we estimate the cost of labor, we typically include employee benefits. There's often an assumption of 30%. There's efforts that have been underway to figure out what is actual overhead costs, and this is sort of the cost of running the facility. So think of it as not just your benefits, but this is the IT and the HR that go into running where you work. Arthur Anderson had done this interesting report that looked across different industries. This report has vanished. I went to find the link on it, and it used to be on an academic website, and I can't find it anymore. So there's less on that. Paul Barnett's done two papers trying to empirically estimate overhead costs. It is really hard, but typically there are either assumptions made, and these can really inflate your costs, so be careful here. So I think I've got a few minutes left, Jean, for questions. I see a lot of questions. So in advance, if we don't get to your questions, we'll do best to answer them.
Okay, so there's a question asking, if the amount of time needed for intervention is a small percent of a full-time employee, do we still consider their non-productive time? Because it's difficult to decide how much of the non-productive time was for this intervention.
That's a great question. So the easiest way to do it, which may not always be the best way, is try to come up with, you know, here's their hourly wage and the number of hours, and you have to estimate how many hours it would be in the intervention plus some non-productive component of it. And you're just going to have to make assumptions on that. The reality, though, especially if you're getting into implementation studies, and I don't know how many of you people manage other people, it's really hard to hire somebody part-time. It's really hard to ask someone who's working full-time to squeeze in your intervention. So implicitly, the implementation scientists are onto something, which is these marginal changes, these sort of just tweaks at the envelope, are much harder than they've just looked in computational. You might say, hey, it's only $10, but then the person says, but you're really asking me to stop what I'm doing every month, do this, I can't do it. And so you end up either decrements in quality, or you have to figure out a way to pay more to get it done right. And so there's no easy answer for what that person that really important question that the person raised. If you're struggling with it with a specific, you know, feel free to ask us and we can walk you through on how we might do it or different people might do it. But I think your comment's just dead on.
Okay, great. Another question asks, are there standards for estimating the cost of office space? For example, if the intervention is a collateral duty, would you not need to fold these costs into the estimate?
So there's great data out there from, because people lease and rent market space all the time. So you can do that. What you're not going to find is, let's just say you know, there's a intervention that requires you to build a new operating room. There is no place that you can go on the web or in talking to people that's going to get you sort of the added cost of building an operating room. So most of the interventions that we've done assume something like, hey, you're going to use office space that is a Class A office space because the outreach workers don't need to have clinic space. They just need office space. And so you end up making assumptions like that. There's just no good data on the cost per square foot for hospitals. You could try to track it down what's happening in Denver. They're building a new VA. That's expensive. We all know that. I'm here in Palo Alto. Stanford's building a new hospital. Boy, that's expensive. But there's no good resource on to say what's the cost per square foot in a hospital. Would you add anything to that, Gene? You've worked a lot on this area, too.
No, I think that was a complete answer to that. Another question asks, I think this may be the last question we have time to go over. Do you make conservative estimates of inputs? Example, 21,000 slots over 5 years accounts for things like robot downtime for maintenance, clinic closings, et cetera.
Yeah, so that's another great question. So most of the time, depending on how you want to build your models, you're going to have point estimates and variances. And so if you wanted to, you could build a very sophisticated model that sort of estimates the number of slots per day, and then maybe there's storms. You could build super sophisticated micro simulations of these things. Most of the time when we go in for the grant proposal and write this, the funding isn't there for that. So we end up with these models we're trying to estimate the cost, and then we'll vary those. And typically, like your question raises, we tend to make a more conservative approach. It would be silly to say that the robot's going to run 24/7 when we know that no one's going to want to be the PT on staff during the night and no patient's going to come in during the night. That would just be a crazy way to deflate the cost.
I just want to point out that there is a question asking about DSS and CA data in terms of the cost of intervention. So I just wanted to point out that we have a lecture next week that will go over MCA costs in more detail. There was another question asking, does Todd have a paper published that summarizes the things he went over in this lecture? And so we do have a lot of information on our website under implementation. And Todd, do you want to add anything to those 2 points?
If there's specific questions, feel free to always reach out to us. We'll do our best to get back to you and say point you to exact specific examples of how it's been done, whether it's our work or somebody else's work, so we can help with that. I think we're in the process of, we've been talking internally of sort of revising some of our web pages to make them more focused on questions that are being asked out there. And so let's just say I want to do an economic evaluation of an implementation trial. And so we're trying to figure out how to best organize it around the type of question you're asking versus here's data, here's methods, here's facts or whatnot. So we're struggling with that, but if there are questions, feel free to reach out to us. We'd love to hear from you and hopefully improve our resources for others. It sounds like we're at the top of the hour, and so I see that there's a lot of questions we didn't get to. So what we'll probably have to do is get the questions, your email, and then respond to you directly if we can. So thank you so much for all your time and for coming to today's cyber seminar.